This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. Vaccines and its vital role in public health have long been controversial, and COVID-19 has seemingly only served to heighten that fear and distrust towards vaccines, even among people who previously were not. But when experts point out that those who refuse vaccinations are often the quote-unquote noisy few, how do we cut through the noise and make sure that vaccines get into people's arms and ultimately save lives? How much have vaccines shaped our history of public health and put an end to vaccine-preventable deaths in the past decade? So joining me all the way from New York for today's show is Nina Schwalbe, who is the Principal Visiting Fellow at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health, as well as an Adjunct Associate Professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Now, Nina has had decades of experience working in the field of immunization with organizations like UNICEF, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, the Global Fund, and most recently as the Director of Vaccine Access and Delivery Initiative at USAID. She now also serves as one of the commissioners on the Lancet Commission on Gender and Global Health, which I'll get to later on as well. But first, welcome to the show, Nina. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thanks so much, Sue Ann. Nice to be here today.
Now, I've given quite a long introduction to your background, just to give some context to our listeners about what we want to talk about today, which is immunization. In your years, you know, working in this field, what have you seen in terms of the impact of vaccines in preventing diseases and deaths? What difference has it made on the lives of people across the world?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. I mean, vaccines and vaccination have had a remarkable impact. In just less than three decades, child mortality has been cut in half, which is a remarkable accomplishment. And each year, more than 80% of kids around the globe receive life-saving vaccines. 80% of kids receive life-saving vaccines. This is also an enormous accomplishment. And the statistics and numbers that we could quote are huge. 5 million deaths prevented every year. And also vaccines have economic benefits. So a study that was published last year in Health Affairs shows that for every dollar invested in vaccination, you save $21 in healthcare costs. So really it's a remarkable intervention. Which has saved millions of lives and will continue to. The other thing that's so great about vaccines is that it's like a mortgage plan on health. So you invest now, you get a shot now, and that shot protects you for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So it's a paid off mortgage plan for your health.
It's just one jab in your arm and you're protected for the rest of your life in many cases. Now, we've achieved that. But on the flip side, you know, I understand that there have been many roadblocks as well, even with effective vaccines available. What have been some of the vaccine preventable diseases that we could have eradicated or at least drastically reduced, but we haven't? And what's stopping us from doing that?
Now, that's a great question. So eradication is a tough one because it's one of these terms where it gets really super technical in public health. So eradication means no cases anywhere, ever in mm-hmm. the world, not one. So that's a tough one. And it's only ever been done with smallpox. Mm-hmm. And with polio, we're really, really close. We've by working together as a global community, every country doubling down on polio, we're very close to eradication. They're, you know, having since 1998, we've decreased by 99.99%. It's almost 100, but it's not quite 100. And for eradication, it has to be 100. But it's true that nearly 1.5 million kids still die from vaccine preventable diseases every year. Diseases like rotavirus, which causes severe and fatal diarrhea in children, or pneumococcal pneumonia, which is causes many more child deaths than it needs to because it's vaccine preventable. So if we think about elimination, so we can definitely do better. There are over 25 vaccine preventable diseases. We can do better on all of them. And if we think about elimination, which is when a region itself sets a goal, so instead of eradication, which is where the world sets a goal to have no cases, regions also double down and say, okay, in our region, we're going to eliminate these diseases. There are a few where there is a global effort now and a push for elimination. And interestingly, those are all diseases where you immunize the person. Either you immunize the mom before she has the baby, or you immunize the baby in its first few days of life. So this is one that people feel is doable, because most women and all women should be getting some sort of prenatal care. It's also another goal. So it dovetails with another important public health goal, which is to get moms prenatal care and to get kids early care at birth. So maternal and neonatal tetanus is one. Very close. Only 12 countries haven't reached elimination. Rubella, another disease. Almost 50 countries have eliminated it. Hepatitis B, which is given as a birth dose to babies. Immunization could be achieved if we could get a dose of that vaccine to every baby born. So there are a number of elimination targets that are feasible and on the horizon. But even if we don't eliminate and reach that very technical term, mm-hmm. we can still do a lot better in reducing the illness and deaths from these diseases.
Mm. It's putting the goals in what's more achievable and in terms of results that we can see in terms of the health of the population, right? Rather than technical things like no cases at all.
That's right. That's right. And you can do, you know, you can do your best and then things happen. But getting it down to one or two cases per year is pretty good, especially when we consider that a century ago, these were all major global killers.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of issues stemming from lack of vaccines or, you know, issues with immunization, when we read about it, if it seems like many people often think that this is a problem that exists only in the global South, is that a fair judgment for people to make? You know, what's the reality like on the ground?
It's really country by country and community by community. So in every country, there are populations that are not reached or missed. Mm. And it can depend. Some countries have laws that make it very difficult to go to school, if not impossible to go to school, if you're not mm-hmm. vaccinated. So that's a policy intervention that helps sort of, if you will, kind of force vaccine acceptance, although there are always ways to get around it as well. But most countries do have pockets of kids who are not receiving vaccines. And I think it's important to remember that most vaccines are aimed at children. Most vaccines are aimed at children under five. So really that, when we've talked about vaccines and immunization programs in the past, we've really been talking about programs that are aimed at reaching kids.
If we then look at what's happening now, right, the situation brought on by COVID-19, particularly with vaccines and the speed at which research and development into vaccines happen, what are some key lessons we've learned? You know, what did we do well? What were the gaps that we can apply for future research and development in developing vaccines for known or future unknown diseases?
Yeah. And just before we get on that, I think one of the things that we've learned during, if there is another pandemic, is that we can't stop basic vaccine and immunization services. Because services were closed in many places or people were afraid to go to the clinic, a number of kids just missed out. 23 million kids didn't receive any vaccines in 2020. That's a lot of kids that didn't get vaccinated, protected against some of the most basic killers like measles that have not yet been eliminated or eradicated and run pretty rampant through our communities. So one thing that I certainly learned, and I think we learned here in New York as well as globally, WHO has put out a report on the number of services that were stopped because of the pandemic, is that we have to continue to provide basic health services. And number one among those, provide immunization, even when we face war or pandemic or other crises in the world. So if we look now, if we turn to R&D and what happened and what we learned, I mean, I think on the incredibly positive side is when the pandemic first broke out, I certainly thought that it would take a decade mm-hmm. to make a new vaccine, because that's our history. It takes decades to make new vaccines. And I think for those of us that work in global health, we work mostly on diseases of poverty. And for diseases of poverty, it takes decades plus to make vaccines, because there's really no profit incentive or profit margin on investing in research and development to produce those vaccines. Mm-hmm. So what happened with COVID was just absolutely remarkable, incredible. In less than a year, we learned that when there's a will, there's a way. And with funding and effort and the promise of a very large global market, everybody on the planet, we can produce vaccines quickly and at a scale never seen before. But there were definitely some lessons that we learned. And one was that there were first and second and third in line on the products that were produced. So the vaccine manufacturers did put profit over access. And we saw that just literally by who was first in line for the vaccines. We saw Europe first in line. And I'm speaking less of the Chinese vaccines. I know less about those and more of the ones produced in Europe and the US. Mm-hmm. But we saw Europe and the US first in line, very little transparency on when other countries would get those vaccines. And I think there are things that we can do better next time. First of all, these vaccines were almost all produced with funding that came from governments. Our governments, our taxpayer money went into producing those vaccines. They got mm-hmm. government funding to help them with the research and development. And I think that should come with a commitment to sharing intellectual property, vaccine and manufacturing knowledge, training manufacturers in vaccine producing regions so that they can get up to speed on production, on quality assurance, on regulatory affairs. I also think that buyers have some responsibility so that when international organizations or big governments are buying big amounts of vaccine, they can require the manufacturers to have some sort of transparency, transparency on price, transparency on who's in line for what quantities. And so that low-income countries also get prioritized in distribution. And I think the other thing that we learned was that when we're developing vaccines, we need to make sure that the users are represented in the vaccine development process. So that means on one hand, you want to make sure that there are geographical representation of people in clinical trials. There are women in clinical trials. There are pregnant women in clinical trials because they're going to get the vaccines at the end anyway. So you need to plan for that. Maybe not the first trial, but the second or the third for sure. And then also you need to make sure that those voices are included so that the products that are developed are also appropriate for low income countries and middle income countries where they may not have the distribution resources that are available to richer countries. And an example of that is the cold chain. There was a lot that was discussed in the early part of the pandemic about the cold chain requirements. The mRNA vaccines need to be kept really, really, really cold or they go bad. And so just thinking that through more upfront and then what that would require then for countries to deliver a vaccine like that means that if we bring more voices from the global south and from marginalized populations to the discussions, we should be able to solve some of those problems upfront.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of thought needs to go in even before the vaccines are produced and distributed, right? It shouldn't be something that's left as an afterthought. Oh, okay, now I've produced the vaccines. I've just passed it on to the countries and it's up to them to figure it out what to do next.
That's right. And that's why organizations like the World Health Organization set out what they call target product profiles for new vaccines. So they say, we're only going to endorse this vaccine if it meets the following criteria. It has to be easy to deliver. It has to be easy to transport. And target product profiles are a really important way of putting forward voice of what people and actual people and health systems on the ground need to be able to deliver life-saving interventions.
I'm speaking today to Nina Schwabe, a principal visiting fellow at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health and an adjunct associate professor at Columbia University's Milman School of Public Health. We are talking about immunization, what we've learned from COVID-19 and the past decade, and what we can improve upon to better tackle vaccine-preventable diseases moving on. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Su Ann. Joining me on Zoom today, all the way from New York, is Nina Schwabe, Principal Visiting Fellow with the United Nations University International Institute of Global Health. And we've been talking about immunization, both during COVID and with childhood vaccinations that have been ongoing for the past decades. Now, before the break, I was speaking to Nina about what we did well with vaccine R&D during COVID. And what we didn't do so well during that time, and really what we need to think of before R&D even happens. Now, the next step after vaccine development, right, would be getting those jabs into people's arms. But one challenge with this that we really saw during COVID as well was misinformation and vaccine hesitancy. And now that isn't new. But what impact do you think COVID has had on the spread of vaccine hesitancy? And how do you see that potentially affecting progress of other vaccinations, especially childhood vaccines?
I think there was so much that led into questions about hesitancy. And there was also a lot of hype about hesitancy. So there were a lot of misbeliefs about COVID vaccines that led to vaccine hesitancy and refusal. And these were really fueled by purposeful efforts to spread dis and misinformation to highlight people's fears. And lockdown, of course, channeled us all online, reading our Twitter feeds and our LinkedIn and our Facebook pages as we never had before. And that also helped people target us, all of our deepest fears, pretty much every subject. It's important to remember, as you noted, that vaccine hesitancy was an issue before COVID-19. And actually in 2019, WHO put it as among their top 10 threats to global health. So adding to the misinformation, COVID itself also led to barriers to vaccination because people were afraid to go out and services were closed. But for me, there's a good news on the story. And the good news is, look at your vaccination rates in Malaysia, incredibly high. So people are getting vaccinated. And a lot of the hype was confused with access to the vaccines because rich countries essentially hoarded the vaccines early on. A lot of people just didn't have access to the vaccines. So it's hard to say until everybody has full potential access, whether it's hesitancy that drove them not to get a vaccine or whether it was lack of access. And it's a little bit hand in hand. You know, you're more likely to do something when your friends and neighbors have done it and they were okay with it. Skepticism is part of pretty much everything we do. And if we know friends and neighbors that have done it, we did a study here in New York City, which showed that it's really important what your healthcare workers think about. The people that you trust are people that you know who are healthcare workers, doctors, and nurses. And if those people are comfortable, then you're going to be more comfortable because you ask your neighbor who's a nurse at the hospital what she or he thinks. And they say, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's fine. So I think one of the lessons for us is, and that's a really important part of the population to work with in advance and make sure that all of their questions are answered. Same with community leaders, your imam, your priest, your rabbi, to make sure that people who are community leaders are well informed about the vaccines, its potential side effects, what to do if you have a side effect, as well as friends and neighbors, making sure people have the information that they need, because everybody does have a trusted source of information. And that is different in different contexts. So I'm positive when I look at the global vaccine numbers and I see how many people have taken a COVID-19 vaccine, and I look at even places where vaccine access was very limited for the first year of the vaccine, those numbers are growing. So I think it's heartening. We used to joke, I once heard the head of a major vaccine company say that his dream was to have his brand be a household name in every country. And right now it's just remarkable. We have people sitting around dinner tables talking about, did you get Pfizer or Moderna or Sinovac or AstraZeneca? I mean, my guess is that's not what they were talking about at dinner 3 years ago. So we have people with an awareness and understanding of vaccines to the level of which vaccines did you get? Like, did you have a Coke or a Pepsi? That is a remarkable advertisement for vaccines. So I'm heartened. When COVID started, I had to explain to people, often I teach it at Columbia and I'm a fellow at UNU, so people will come and ask me questions. I had to explain to people what's herd immunity and what's a vaccine and how does it work. This was a remarkable education opportunity. I think now if you gave everybody a quiz on those basic questions about vaccine, I think as a world, we'd come out pretty well.
Now, you mentioned earlier about how progress with some childhood vaccinations was stalled because of COVID-19 prevention measures, the lockdowns and all that. But do you think the hesitancy, whatever pockets that we saw with COVID-19, will that affect progress of other childhood vaccinations? Or is it still too early to tell?
I think it's early to tell. My speculation would be not. I mean, we have In looking at some of the data here, I think it's very context specific. I think as we look at the data, mm-hmm. we see pretty much the same pockets of hesitancy. What's different at COVID is that before, when you give a kid a vaccine, you have to take the kid to the vaccination site. It's either mm-hmm. done by a caregiver, usually a mom. So if the mom is on board, then the kid goes to the site. And I think what's different about this vaccine is that it's an adult vaccine. So we had a lot more articulation of the hesitancy because it was adults themselves, men and women, deciding for themselves whether or not to get a vaccine. And that was a new situation as opposed to getting vaccines for your kids. And we heard from a colleague who's the new vaccine introduction advisor at the World Health Organization in Africa that it hasn't affected childhood vaccination. What people do for themselves and decisions they make about themselves are very different from the decisions that they make around their children. And for most people, they would do anything possible to make sure that their children are protected for life against threatening health diseases. So I'm again an optimist that what we saw is pockets. What we get out of this is an understanding, a better understanding of who's hesitant, why they're hesitant, and what we can do to address hesitancy, and that we'll actually come out of the pandemic stronger.
Mm. Now, you mentioned how lockdown pushed us further online, right? Do you think social media, as well as the fact that many of us seemingly interact within very particular news bubbles, you know, we read only select news sites that already align with our own views, does that make it more difficult to tackle vaccine hesitancy because information has become such specific channels to specific groups of people?
That is a problem globally about every issue that we face, is these reinforcing bubbles of social media. I'm an optimist again and hopeful that the COVID-19 pandemic and its omnipresence in every aspect of our lives has maybe broken up those bubbles a little bit to mm-hmm. have people realize that maybe their bubble is actually a bubble and that there are other opinions out there.
Mm. All right. Misinformation is only one barrier to getting people vaccinated, right? How much do other barriers, especially logistical or financial ones, also impede people's access to vaccinations, you know, be it COVID-19 or life-saving childhood vaccinations?
Vaccination is two things. In order to be vaccinated, you need vaccines and you need delivery. So the first thing is the vaccines. And I think with COVID-19, that was definitely a problem for many countries and places with the delay, the rollout first in certain parts of the world, and now only just now reaching other parts of the world. So we have so-called supply side issues and we have demand side issues around reaching people with life-saving vaccines, including childhood immunization. The supply side isn't only about the vaccine. It's also about the system that delivers the vaccine. And that's why we say vaccination is the sum of vaccines and delivery. So there's a lack of general funding. That's true for healthcare services, for primary healthcare services overall. We have a shortage in health workforce, especially the health workforce that gives vaccines. There's a lack of distribution capacity, including to the last mile for many vaccines, childhood vaccines as well. We have equipment shortages. All vaccines, while some of the COVID vaccines required super cold environments, all vaccines have to be kept cold. And keeping those vaccines cold all the way down to the child who reaches them is a problem. So there are a number of supply, what we call in the business supply side factors, which are as important, albeit at a different scale, for regular basic childhood immunizations as they were for COVID-19. So then if we move to the sort of to the demand side, I think what COVID-19 showed us was the importance of clear context-specific population-based strategies. So when we're doing routine childhood immunization, we literally take a map of a neighborhood and map every household. And we say, how many kids are in household A, B, C? And we talk to the health worker, and the health worker goes out to reach every one of those children. And that's where also data come into play. In order to know who's missing in a vaccine program, you need to have the data to understand where people live, what are their households, how many kids, what are their ages, and then their vaccination status. So I think COVID-19 has shown us the barriers that also exist for childhood vaccines. And I'm going to give you an example of New York City. I live right next to a housing population of elderly people. I actually live right next to Chinatown in New York City. And we have elderly people who don't speak actually that much English, not enough to understand or register on the website. Mm-hmm. And of course, it wasn't rocket science to guess that those people would not be first in line at the vaccination site. They couldn't get access to the internet. They couldn't use the English language interface. And many of them actually did not have the means to be able, physical means to be able to walk to the site. So what's the answer to that? That's something we know very well from childhood vaccines. You bring the services to them. You bring mobile services. You actually can even bring healthcare workers door to door to help vaccinate those people. So a lot of the barriers that we saw with COVID-19 vaccines are barriers we've faced with childhood vaccines and barriers that we can overcome with adequate health workers, numbers of health workers, adequate financing for the gas, to take the van, to go to the community, and messaging and working together with communities to understand what they need and how to get vaccines to them. So same problems, same solutions, just a different population in that normally we're dealing with kids. So we're talking to the caregivers, and with COVID-19, we're dealing with the whole population.
Were you surprised or are you surprised that vaccine inequity is still such a serious matter now at this point, 2 years into the pandemic? Was this something that we could have predicted based on past vaccination campaigns?
Vaccine inequity has been a problem. It's when every time we have a new vaccine, there's a delay between when that vaccine is introduced in rich countries, mm-hmm. even then to middle income, let alone low income countries. So, and although there was some degree of pre-planning for it, I think we underestimated the challenge of what it would take. So I was disappointed, but not surprised that we were so slow to get the vaccines out to low-income countries. And even middle-income countries like had to wait after the high-income countries had their first charge at the supply.
Do you think vaccines should be a public good? I mean, and you said you're optimistic, right? But are you optimistic that we could one day see vaccines being pushed as a public good rather than for profit as what we're seeing now with quite a number of vaccines?
Vaccines are a public good. we invest them, governments invest to produce them, mm-hmm. and governments purchase them for their population. If that's not a public good, I don't know what is. I think that the profit model has to switch, and that there have to be more hammers on the industry for compliance to make sure that vaccines are seen not only as a national public good, but also as a global public good. I think that's the shift we have to make. And I think that by requiring, when rich countries make large purchases of vaccines, they can require manufacturers to also make sure that those vaccines are available in poorer countries. When they're investing in research and development, they can put access pricing clauses, access agreement, access manufacturing clauses. There's a whole range of tools that could be used to do this better. It's important also to understand that with vaccine manufacturing, you can get cheaper manufacturing in general because of economies of scale. Mm-hmm. And that means that the more you produce, the cheaper you can make the product. And it's tough with vaccines because they're produced in big, huge vats. I like to say that it's sort of a mix between a beer factory and a neonatal intensive care unit. So in the beer factory, they're produced in these enormous vats, millions of doses sometimes per batch. Mm-hmm. And yet that has to be completely sterile environment as if you're dealing, again, with an immunocompromised person. So everybody's in white suits with gloves and hats and headgear because the environment has to be kept incredibly sterile. And if that gets compromised in any way, you have to throw the whole thing away because you really don't want people to get sick. Vaccines are given to healthy people, not sick people. So you have to be really careful that vaccines actually don't make people sick. So the point here is that vaccines are now considered a national public good. They should be a global public good. And there are some ways that we can enforce that by being harder on manufacturers.
Hmm. So the solution would be almost national, right? It's on countries to impose stronger rules or regulations upon manufacturers operating within their borders.
I mean, I think that's the strongest way to do it because they're the biggest investors. They're the majority share investors, and it's their shareholders. It's the shareholders that are going to make a difference in these companies. But the majority share investor is usually the country in which the manufacturer is located. I think also international procurement agencies can do the same. So it's ever the big buyers are. The big buyers have more leverage than they think they do on who ultimately gets access to the product.
Would those big buyers be, I guess, organizations like, you know, I understand like UNICEF, for example, or bodies like COVAX?
Bodies like COVAX could put conditions on manufacturers in their contracts. They contract with manufacturers and they could put conditions, just like they could put conditions on countries to report gender disaggregated data. They have a lot of leverage as the major funder. UNICEF is an interesting point because they buy on behalf of countries. So a country comes to UNICEF and says, could you please purchase vaccine X for me or on behalf of me? So in that case, pressure also will need to come from countries themselves.
COVAX in particular has been at the receiving end of quite a number of criticisms, right, for failing to meet its targets, for not being able to procure vaccines for low and middle income countries. Do you think there's a continued place for a body such as COVAX or other international health bodies to continue providing vaccinations, so to help lower and middle income countries get access to vaccines?
I think absolutely. If you look at the success of Gavi over the last 20 years, it tracks directly to the number of childhood deaths that have been essentially halved since its inception. Gavi and COVAX, there would have been no voice for low-income countries. The mechanisms work because it's a collective buying power. So it takes the power of one country and it aggregates demand to give smaller countries, poorer countries, more collective buying power. And that is a critical part of the model moving forward.
Do you think that we take vaccines for granted and that vaccines have become a victim of its own success?
I think when we see people, moms waiting in line with kids for vaccines, missing work, skipping school to get their kids vaccinated, I don't think most moms take their vaccines or their children's vaccines for granted. I think we have to be vigilant to continue to educate people about the role and power of vaccines. My mentor in public health told me once, Nina, when public health's working, nobody knows you're there. And when public health's not working, everybody knows you're there. And I think that is true also. So we have to remind people that the public health professionals that are working every day are working to keep your water clean, your food safe, your sewage disposed of. So, and it's only when it's not working that you hear about it. So I do think maybe we need a national public health workers day to remind people of the public health that goes on invisibly behind the scenes every day.
That's the challenge with public health, isn't it? Because the work that you do is silent, it's invisible, and the effects of that aren't always immediate, right? You see the successes of it in 5 years, 10 years, when diseases that are vaccine preventable don't exist anymore, or, you know, they only occur in rare cases, right? Small little outbreaks or cases here and there. And that's when you really see the impact of public health. Let's go for one last break, Nina. And when we come back, I want to talk about the intersection between gender and global health, how that ties into immunization as well. I'm speaking today to Nina Schwalbe, Principal Visiting Fellow at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health and Adjunct Associate Professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Su Ann. On the show with me today is Nina Schwalbe, Principal Visiting Fellow at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health. And we've been talking about immunization and how we can improve vaccination strategies nationally, within your own countries, within your own borders, but globally as well. Now, Nina, you're also one of the commissioners on the Lancet Commission on Gender and Global Health, which was established back in 2020. Could you tell me more about the commission and why it's important for us to talk about gender and global health instead of, you know, just global health?
Yeah, the Lancet Commission on Gender was set up to understand if we're making progress on gender, health equity, and health equality by 2030, which coincides with the end of the period of the Sustainable Development Goals. And the idea is to mobilize individuals and institutions to produce a feminist, intersectional, evidence-based analysis, which catalyzes action on gender and global health. And what we mean by intersectional is this idea of recognizing that women aren't just women, they're also caregivers. Men aren't just men. They have multiple roles in society. So it's a mistake to just think of any person in one with one quantifier or one qualifier or one way that we describe them, that everybody has multiple roles. In terms of gender and immunization, you know, it's really important to help think through the gender barriers of immunization, for an example, and that's an area that I'm specifically interested in and working on, which is to think about why is it that there are gender differences and what are gender differences in access? And often we make a mistake in looking just at, did boys and girls get equally vaccinated? And that's part of it, but does that mean did boys and girls get equally vaccinated, or does it mean that female-headed households versus non-female households had the same access to vaccination services as more traditional households? So gender is a lens that we need to look at when we're looking at access to services more than just did men and women or boys and girls get equal access to care. We need to look at it to understand were there particular barriers like taking time off work or stigma associated with getting a vaccine that affect one gender more than they affect another gender? And if so, what can we as health services professionals do to try to decrease or address those barriers?
You would think that this is something that was already considered, but I guess is this, how new is this idea of looking at health, public health issues from a gender lens?
It's not a new issue. It's been around since I started my career and well before, but it's not one that's received particular attention. And the idea of the Lancet Commission is to try to get it front and center again on everybody's radar. It's, you could look through, I mean, the feminist movement really has been around for centuries and has continually been ignored. So it's not a new issue, but we are very hopeful, again, Nina Schwalbe, the optimist, that COVID-19 will be a new impetus to try to put us over the edge and finally address not only gender as a determinant of health, but other social determinants of health. And what we mean by that is, to what extent does your race limit your access to services? To what extent does your ethnicity limit your access to services? To what extent does your income status or your age influence your access to services? We feel that if countries aren't reporting even on whether men and women are getting vaccinated at equal rates, that it's very hard to believe they'll report on other things that determine whether or not you get access to health. So I am hopeful that just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean it can't be done moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And just a couple more questions to wrap up. You know, in the world that we live in today, based on what we've seen, based on the socioeconomic impact that we've seen with COVID-19, can we afford to continue looking at vaccines and vaccinations as simply a health problem? What are the possible hurdles if we continue to sort of push this as something that the Ministry of Health of your country deals with, or the World Health Organization only deals with?
Health is a global public good, and as such, it has to be dealt with by all ministries. It has to be dealt with by the Ministry of Finance. It has to be dealt with by the Ministry of Transport. And I hope as well that COVID-19 was a kick to everyone that you can't just deal. First of all, you can't just deal with one disease, because we see the impact that the policy reactions to this disease had on other basic health services. And also, you really need to think about a holistic approach, bringing lots of different government sectors together. That's why we also think that right now the United Nations is discussing a new treaty, mm-hmm. which would cover pandemic preparedness. And whether it's going to be a treaty or an instrument or what it's going to be is all up to debate. A number of us as advocates believe that it needs to be higher than the World Health Organization for exactly the reasons that you just mentioned, is that if it's within the World Health Organization, it's limited to ministers of health, which they're very powerful and extremely important people, but they can't solve these problems alone. It has to be at the level of head of state, because this affects trade, this affects well-being, this affects economic prospects, this affects every single aspect of life as we live it.
And what do you think we, you know, be it society as a whole, individual countries or global organizations need to focus on if we want to step up vaccinations across the board, you know, not just for COVID-19, but for other vaccine preventable diseases that we have vaccines for now?
We need to focus really as in the next, between now and 2030, on who's missing. People who have access to services have access to services, and we have to double down on the people who aren't getting access and figure out how to reach them. Because if we can reach them with one life-saving intervention, we can reach them with many other services that are critical for their health and well-being.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Nina.
Thank you, Sue-Ann. Thank you very much.
You just heard from Nina Schwalbe, Principal Visiting Fellow at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health and an Adjunct Associate Professor at Columbia University's Milman School of Public Health, who has been sharing lessons that we can learn from the pandemic to improve how we tackle vaccinations moving on and protecting people from vaccine-preventable diseases, both those that we already know and those that we don't know yet. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.